You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eternal and Transient Elements, The Cosmic Past of Humanity and the Mystery of Evil. Collected Works, Volume 184, translated by Anna Moyes. I will mention as well that there are 15 lectures here given at Dornach, Switzerland, from the 6th of September to the 13th of October. Lecture 1, given on the 6th of September, 1918. I'd like to go more deeply into some of the things we have been considering here this summer, and we'll add some historical details and also some factual things in the next few days. Today I intend to draw your attention to some historical facts and then present you with some conclusions drawn from a deeper study of these, and particularly from the revelations of some historical figures. Initiates of the mysteries have, through the ages, always said one thing, rightly so. It is that if one does not know how to judge the two streams in philosophical life properly, two streams we have been considering, idealism and materialism, one will be in danger of either falling through a trap door into a pokey little cellar hole, or coming to a dead end in the search for a philosophy of life. The cellar has been considered by initiates of all times to be dualism, where one does not find the bridge from ideas, spiritual thinking tinged with theory, to the sphere of matter, of material things. And the dead end one may reach in following different ways of looking at the world, when one does not manage to balance idealism against materialism, is what initiates call fatalism. In more recent times, there has been a definite tendency to take a dualistic view, and on the other hand, to be fatalistic, though there are things which those taking the present-day views fail to admit or do not even realize. To begin with, I would like to take one individual who lived in the evening twilight of the fourth post-Atlantean era, just in general outline, with reference to the philosophy of life, and then look at others who are more characteristic of our present-day philosophy of life, of the fifth post-Atlantean era. One highly characteristic figure with regard to Western philosophy of life was Augustine of Hippo, who lived from 354 to 430 of the Christian era. Let us recall some of Augustine's thoughts, for as you can see from the dates, he lived in the evening twilight of the fourth post-Atlantean era, which came to a conclusion in the 15th century. It is clearly evident that this conclusion was approaching, starting from the 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th post-Christian centuries. Augustine gained impressions of many different philosophies of life. We have spoken of this before. Above all, Augustine came to know Manichaeism and skepticism. His soul took in all the impulses which one gains when, on the one hand, one sees all that is ideal, beautiful, and good, everything that is filled with wisdom, and then also everything which is bad, evil. And we know that in Manichaeism people sought to manage, putting it crudely, but it can also be put in this way, with these two streams in the philosophies of life, so that in a way they accepted eternal polarity, opposition persisting forever between light and darkness, good and bad, wisdom filled and evil. In Manichaeism, people only managed with this dualism by connecting certain ancient pre-Christian concepts with this acceptance of the polarity of phenomena in the world, and above all, connected certain ideas, which can only be understood if one knows that in earlier times people used an atavistic clairvoyance to see into the spiritual world. ideas that those visions were similar in content to the impressions gained through sensory perception. Having taken in such ideas, I'd say, of the supersensible as seemingly sensible, Manichaeism gave the impression for many people of making the spiritual material, of envisaging the spiritual in forms that are sense perceptible. This is a common mistake made also in more recent philosophies, including more recent theosophy, as I've been telling you the other day. Augustine gave up Manichaeism for the very reason that he could no longer bear the way things were made sensible, material. That was one of the reasons why he gave it up. Augustine then also went through skepticism, which is a justifiable philosophy of life, insofar as it makes people aware that merely considering anything which is to be gained from the sense-perceptible world, and the experiences and events in the sense-perceptible world, will not tell them anything about the supersensible. And if one then also holds the view that one cannot gain the supersensible as such, one will doubt if truth is to be found at all. Augustine also went through this doubt without knowing the truth. He gained the most powerful impulses from this. Now, in order to make you understand what really gave Augustine the position he had in Western philosophy, I have to refer to the main element in his point of view, a point from which all the light shone out that lived in Augustine, and was indeed the main point in his last philosophy of life. It is the point which we may characterize as follows. Augustine realized that human beings can only be certain, truly certain, with a certainty free from all delusion, if they refer to their own inner experience. Everything else can be uncertain. It is impossible to know if the things we see with our eyes, hear with our ears, things that make an impression on any of our senses, truly are constituted the way our senses make us assume. We cannot even know what this world actually looks like if we close our eyes and ears and other senses to it. That is how people think, who think in the Augustinian way about the outside world, which they can experience. They think that this outside world, which they can experience as it presents itself to human beings, could not provide true certainty, that nothing can be gained from it on which one might base oneself as a fixed point in a philosophy of life. But with regard to the things which people experience inwardly, irrespective of how they do so, being with them directly, it is the individual himself who lives in the ideas, the feelings inside him. One knows that one is right within one's inner life. For a thinker like Augustine, the fact inwardly experienced is that, with regard to anything human beings inwardly experience as truth, they can be under no delusion. You may think that everything else which the world says may be deceptive, but there can be absolutely no doubt that the ideas, the feelings that live in us, are really and truly experienced by us in our inner life. This solid basis for accepting one truth about which there can be no doubt was one of the starting points in Augustine's philosophy of life. In the fifth post-Atlantean era, this point was taken up in a most striking way by Descartes, who lived from 1596 to 1650, already in the dawn, therefore, of the fifth post-Atlantean era. For Descartes, too, saw this element which remains, when all else is in doubt, as the starting point, and he put it in the well-known words, "I think, therefore I am." And he was really wholly in accord with Augustine in taking this view. Now, the situation is that when it comes to one's philosophy of life, one always has to say, quote, "Someone who is in the stream of human evolution at some point in time will have certain views. There will be certain aspects of his views of which he is not aware. people who come later will see them. Close quote. We might say that those who come later are privileged to see something in a fuller and truer sense than someone who has to say certain things at a particular time in human evolution. This is a fact that cannot be denied. And it is good, as I have mentioned on previous occasions, if people who are taking our anthroposophical point of view will consciously and thoroughly realize the following. The knowledge of spiritual things one is able to gain at the present time, however distinctive it may be, must not be taken as a sum of absolute dogmas. It has to be clearly understood that there will be others at a later time who will see a greater truth in such things as we are able to present today than we are able to see for ourselves. This is indeed the basis for humanity's cultural evolution. And any obstacle to all inhibition of cultural advance ultimately depends on people not being prepared to admit that they would really like to be given truths that are not the truths of a particular era, but are absolute, timeless dogmas. Today, in particular, we are able to look back from our point of view on Augustine, and we'll have to say to ourselves, quote, if one takes the Augustinian point of view, one will have to be very clear in one's mind that he assumed uncertainty as to the truth in all external revelations, but genuine truth in experiencing the things that live in our soul. Close quote. It calls for a degree of courage for someone to take this point of view. Perhaps one would not need to speak of this in the decided fashion in which I have to do it, if it were not the case that exactly in our time, courage would characteristically be lacking when it comes to philosophies of life. This courage to which I am referring shows itself in two directions. One is that, like Augustine, you boldly admit, quote, you will have genuine certainty only with regard to anything you experience inwardly. Close quote. Then, there has to be the other pole of this courage, and at the present time this is indeed lacking. One must then also have the courage to admit to oneself, quote, the revelation of external things through the senses does not have this genuine certainty of their being real. Close quote. It does need inner courage in our thinking to say that there is no genuine certainty about external reality, which is considered to be absolutely certain in modern materialism. On the other hand, it needs a degree of courage to say to oneself, quote, genuine certainty comes only if one is really aware of one's inner experiences. Close quote. Yes, even in our day, this has been said again, and there are people who ask others, people who want to develop a philosophy of life, to have this courage, which shows itself in two ways. Yet we have to think differently about this today, if we really want to get to the bottom of things. And there we see the whole historical position held by Augustine for the people of today, and that our thinking about the matter has to be somewhat different. For today we have to know something which Augustine or Descartes did not consider. I have discussed this in the part of my book titled The Riddle of Man, where I was referring to Descartes. Today, we have to say, quote, the idea that one might arrive at a satisfactory philosophy of life by grasping the direct inner life of man, the way people experience it today, this idea is refuted every time we go to sleep. Close quote. Every time someone falls back into the unconscious state of sleep in our day, he or she will be deprived not of the absolute true certainty of inner experience of which Augustine spoke, but of the reality of this inner experience. The reality of this genuine experience is always lost from going to sleep to waking up again. Today, human beings experience the inner life in a slightly different way from the way people did as late as the fourth post-Atlantean era, and even in the evening twilight of Augustine's day. Today they have to say, quote, however clearly, However exactly a certainty may be inwardly experienced, it still offers no certainty for life after death. For the simple reason that we see reality sink down into the unconscious sphere every time we sleep. And the people of today do not know if it does not also sink down into unreality. Close quote. So today we may no longer conclude that things inwardly experienced in seemingly absolute certainty cannot be called in question. In theory, none of it can be called in question, but the fact of sleep goes against this. Turning our attention to what has just been said, we will immediately see how Augustine was able to arrive at this view, and did so with much greater justification than Descartes, later on, who really was more or less only repeating Augustine's statement. Some late echoes of the old atavistic clairvoyance still existed for the whole fourth post-Atlantean era, including the time when Augustine lived. Sadly, far too little of this is taken note of in history today, and little is known of it. But throughout the whole of the fourth post-Atlantean era, very many people knew from personal experience that there is a spiritual life, for they saw it in their visions. But during that fourth era, they mostly saw it because it entered into their sleep life, and that was different from the way it was in the second and third eras. We may therefore say that in the fourth post-Atlantean era, it was different from the way it is now, in the fifth era, when sleep means being wholly unconscious. In the fourth post-Atlantean era, people still knew that from going to sleep until waking up was a time when the ideas and feelings they had in their waking hours acted in other forms. The waking life of truth went down, as it were, into the dim conscious awareness of sleep life. And they knew that the inner truth they experienced held not only truth, but also reality. For they knew moments in the life of sleep when the things one learns in the inner life were present as real and not merely abstract life. It is immaterial if someone may be able to demonstrate even today that Augustine would have been able to say from personal experience, quote, I know that the things we experience inwardly as true but unreal exist for the time from going to sleep to waking up. Close quote. But it was certainly possible in Augustine's day to gain such a view and base oneself on it. If you now extend what I have been saying with regard to the subjective human principle and generalize it for the whole macrocosm, this will take you to something different. You then discover the element from which this subjective principle actually arose in earlier times, namely in the fourth post-Atlantean era, and what has made it possible. In pre-Christian times, the mystery of Golgotha marks the boundary between the ancient atavistic views and later new ones, which are still evolving today. People were still able to adhere to certain living mystery truths. The truths from the mysteries which I mean here are truths relating to the great secret of birth and death. Some initiates considered the secret of birth and of death to be a secret which should not be made known to the world, because the world was not yet ripe for it. But within the mysteries, some view was also held in pre-Christian times on the connection between birth and death in the macrocosm, man being part of this in the whole of his essential nature. During that time before Christ, it was through the mysteries that attention was above all directed toward birth, toward all that was being born in the world. Anyone familiar with the old philosophies of life will know that the emphasis was on being born, on coming into existence, shooting and sprouting. And I have, of course, made it clear on several occasions that the opposite came with the mystery on Golgotha. I used the following words, quote, consider that about 600 years before Golgotha, Buddha, who in human evolution represents something like the ending of the pre-Christian philosophy of life, did, among other things, develop his views on seeing a corpse. death is suffering, and it was like an axiom for Buddha that suffering must be overcome. The means had to be found to enable one to turn away from death. It was the corpse from which the Buddha turned away to arrive at something which, albeit spiritualized, was to him, nevertheless, something in which one can get a sense of shooting, sprouting life. Looking at life in other regions, 600 years after the mystery on Golgotha, we see that seeing the dead body of the Christ on the cross was not something people would turn away from, but something they would turn toward, something they would look upon with all their heart as the symbol that would solve the riddle of the macrocosm, insofar as it related to the human being and his growth and development. This is a very special relationship within those 12 centuries. 600 years before the mystery on Golgotha, turning away from a corpse, led to something that was to be an elevating principle in the philosophy of life. 600 years after the mystery on Golgotha, the symbol of the cross had evolved, a turning toward death, toward the dead body, to find there the strength to arrive at a philosophy of life that would cast a light also on the progress of man. Among the many things which characterize the tremendous change that came with the mystery on Golgotha is this Buddha symbol of turning away from the dead body, and the Christ symbol of turning toward the dead body, which is seen as the dead body of the most sublime spirit ever to have appeared on earth. It truly was the case that in a certain respect the old mysteries placed the riddle of births at the center of philosophies of life. In doing so, the mysteries, which sought to convey mystery knowledge and not just superficial views, did at the same time present the human soul with a profound cosmological secret. They directed attention to the principle connected with the life of births in world evolution. And you will not be able to understand the life of births in world evolution unless you go back to the ancient riddle of the moon. We know, of course, that before the Earth came to be Earth, it was embodied as the old moon. Various phenomena connected with our present moon, the late descendant of the old moon, you can read it up in my title, Occult Science, An Outline, Reader's Aside, also known as An Outline of Esoteric Science, and a Reader's Aside, have to be seen as late echoes of events that happened in the time of the old moon, a time which preceded Earth evolution. There would be no births, none, in all the realms of nature, in Earth evolution, if the laws of the old moon did not apply, or rather, those of its late descendant, which is the Earth's satellite. Every birthing in all the realms of nature and in humanity is connected with the moon's activities. And it was in connection with this that the ancient Hebrew initiates considered Yahweh to be a moon god. Yahweh is the God who controls all bringing forth. It was understood that, cosmologically, the laws of the moon governed all bringing forth processes in all realms of nature. They were thus able to speak of a profound secret in cosmology, symbolically, as it were, saying, quote, as the light of the moon shines on the earth, all shooting, sprouting life, all births, come from the principle represented by the moonlight, close quote. In the highest mysteries of pre-Christian times, people did not turn to the light of the sun, but to the sun's life as it was reflected by the moon when speaking of the secret of births. The particular nuance given to pre-Christian philosophies of life in their depths had arisen because in the old mysteries people knew the secret of the moon. The light of the sun was considered to be something veiled, something not very good for people, unless they were well prepared. For it was known that it is delusion, Maya, to think that the sun ray coming to earth called forth the shooting, sprouting life forms in the different realms of nature. It was known that getting born did not depend on the life of the sun, but rather the other way round. Being scorched, the diminishing of life did so. The mystery secret was that the moon lets life forms be born, and the sun lets them die. However much people were venerating the life of the sun for other reasons in the pre-Christian mysteries of old, they venerated it as the ground and origin of death. The fact that life forms must die cannot be ascribed to the sun, which we know from title occult science, to have been the second embodiment of the earth, but we can ascribe it to the present sun, which we see on the horizon in all its glory. Well, now, the end of life, which is the opposite of those births, is connected with the life of the sun. But there is also something else, something that was not so important in pre-Christian times, but has become particularly important in post-Christian times. All conscious life is connected with the life of the sun. And the conscious life which human beings go through in a life on earth, that conscious awareness which shines out particularly in the fifth post-Atlantean era, which is our own, is intensively connected with the life of the sun. We merely need to consider this life of the sun from the spiritual point of view, just as we have been doing in the lectures given earlier this summer. Yes, the sun is the creator of death, the scorching life in the cosmos, and also for human beings. But it is at the same time also the creator of conscious life. This conscious life was not so important in pre-Christian times because they still had the atavistic life in clairvoyance inherited from the old moon. Conscious awareness has become important in post-Christian times, more important than life itself. For the goal of Earth evolution can only be achieved if this conscious awareness is gained in an appropriate way. Human beings have to accept this conscious awareness from the one who gives us not only this, but also the life of death, not the life of births. It is with this that through the mystery on Golgotha, the Son of the Sun, the S-O-N of the S-U-N, the Christ entered into earth evolution, going through the living body of Jesus of Nazareth. The power, as it were, which has become the most important principle in earth evolution. This is connected with profound cosmic secrets. Quote, from your sleep life, the initiates of the old mysteries would say to their disciples, a sleep life into which the powers of the moon enter even when you are awake. We know, of course, that human beings are partly asleep even in their waking hours. The life of the moon tinges this life of sleep, just as the silver sickle of the moon tinges the darkness of night. Close quote. Christian initiates have to say to their disciples, quote, seek to understand that conscious awareness shines out from waking life, because the powers of the sun enter into it, just as the sun shines on all life on earth from morning to night. Close quote. The change came with the mystery on Golgotha. In pre-Christian times, it was most important to perceive the origin of life. Now it has become most important to perceive the source and origin of conscious awareness. It is only by knowing how to connect the cosmological truth to which I have been referring with the true certainty that lives in our souls, that is only by grasping spiritual science inwardly, that we will be assured of the reality of the spirit within the principle which otherwise does not assure reality in this inner life. We cannot get far with the means available to Augustine, the means available to those who base themselves on Augustinian principles. Every sleep confutes the genuine certainty of our inner experiences. It will only be when, in addition to these inner experiences, we come to experience their reality that we can gain a genuine firm foothold on the soil of these inner experiences. Anything we think, anything we feel in our present life on earth is not real in this present life on earth. Even today there are some scientific thinkers who acknowledge this. It is unreal for the present time. The strange thing is that our most intimate experience, where the truth shines out for us beyond all doubt, is not real in the present time. but it is the actual perpetuating seed for our next life on earth. We may speak of this principle, of which Augustine spoke, and for which, in his case, there was no guarantee, as the seed for our next life on earth. We may say, quote, "It is definitely true that the truth shines out within us, but does so as something which is not real. Today it is still unreal, but in our next life on earth, this unreal principle, which is seed in its unreality, will be fruit, a fruit which will bring the next life to life, just as this year's seed in a plant will bring the visible plant to life next year." Close quote. We have to overcome time. Only then will we find reality in the things we are able to experience inwardly. We would never be the human beings we are meant to be if at the present time the inwardly experienced truth did have the same reality as the outside world. We would never be able to be free. Freedom would be completely out of the question, nor would we be individuals. We'd be part of the natural order. Anything happening within us would happen of necessity. We only are individuals, and indeed free individuals, because on the billows of necessary developments there arises, like a miracle, the unreality of our inner experiences, something which will only be outward reality of the kind we see in the world around us in our next life on earth. That is the deceptive quality of time, something which still lives in people's fantasies today. People do not consider that anything which inwardly shines out as unreal in one life on earth will be real in the next. Now, this is something we'll be considering further tomorrow and the day after. We see how, from the point of view we are able to gain today, we can survey Augustine's point of view and see something in his way of looking at things, as it were, which he himself was not yet able to see. Thus, Augustine is perhaps especially significant for us as someone in the evening twilight of the fourth post-Atlantean era, because he was, with particular precision, pointing to the ideal, conceptual stream in world events, seeking to find a fixed point in that ideal stream in world events. That is what Augustine tried to do. All we want to do today is to state this historical fact. In his time, people had not yet understood that a tremendous change had come with regard to the mystery on Golgotha and to death. For it is only from this mystery of death that the true consolidation of the absolute certainty of the truths experienced within the human soul can then well forth. We'll now take a big leap and characterize another individual, just as we have been talking about the characteristics of Augustine during the evening twilight of the fourth post-Atlantean era. We're going to consider characteristic individuals of the fifth post-Atlantean era in a particular respect. I'll select two of them. One of them, and beginning with him, we can characterize what emerged for humanity in the fifth post-Atlantean era in one particular respect, was Henri de Saint-Simon, who lived from 1760 to 1825. The other, a follower of Saint-Simon, was Auguste Comte, who lived from 1798 to 1857. Augustine was someone who made every effort, using all means his insights had provided, to consolidate Christianity. Both Saint-Simon and Auguste Comte had grown utterly confused about Christianity. It will be easiest for us to get an idea of the thinking of Auguste Comte, and in a sense also of Saint-Simon, by considering some of Auguste Comte's main ideas, at least in a schematic way. Auguste Comte was very much a representative for a particular kind of philosophy of life. And it was only because people were not much concerned about the way in which the different philosophies fit into people's way of life that someone like Auguste Comte was studied as a rarity in history. What people don't know is that basically, though perhaps not everywhere, people have been influenced by, in a way, been pupils of Auguste Comte, though this is not what matters. deep down in their thinking, they are of the same mind as Auguste Comte. So we are able to say that Auguste Comte is representative of a major part of people's approach to life in the present time. Auguste Comte said, quote, "Humanity has evolved. It has evolved in three stages and has now reached the third stage. If we observe people's inner lives through these three stages, we find that at the first stage, people's ideas inclined mainly toward demonology." Close quote. This means that the first stage of evolution in the Comtean sense would be demonological. Quote, "People imagined that spirits were active, taking effect behind the natural phenomena which are perceived through the senses." Close quote. You have to think of them the way people always imagine spirits to be in ordinary life. Demons are suspected to be everywhere, big ones and small ones. That was the first stage. Then, having developed a bit further, people began to move from the demonological view to a metaphysical one, where they had originally imagined demons, elemental spirits, or the like, behind all phenomena. They now thought of understandable reasons put in abstract terms. People turned metaphysical when they did no longer want to believe in demons. The second stage was therefore metaphysics. Certain concepts were thought up and connected with one's own life, and people thought that they would get to the ground and origin of things with such concepts. Humanity has now also gone beyond this stage and entered into the third stage. Auguste Comte assumed, and this was very much in line with the thinking of his teacher, Saint Simon, that wanting to learn about the ground and origin of the world, people no longer look to the demons, nor to metaphysical concepts, but merely to the sense-perceptible reality provided by positivist science. The third age is thus one of positivist science. People are meant to consider the things revealed to them in external scientific discoveries as enlightening and leading to a philosophy of life. They were to seek enlightenment about themselves in the same way in which mathematical enlightenment casts light on dimensions in space, physics on systems of forces, chemistry on the structure of matter, biology on the systems of life. In his great work on positive philosophy, Auguste Comte sought to give a complete picture of the harmony of everything which the different sciences can tell us, saying that this alone was worthy of man in his third stage of development. He did consider Christianity, saying it was the most sublime development, but nevertheless only as the final phase in demonology. Metaphysics followed. They provided a sum of abstract concepts. But according to Auguste Comte, only positive science arrives at something that is truly real, also offering an existence worthy of humanity. He, therefore, wanted to establish a church based on positivist science, to organize people in social systems which were based on that positivist science. Auguste Comte did in the end arrive at some very strange ideas. I'll just take some characteristic elements today. He spoke a lot about establishing a positivist church. This positivist church, if you study this, you will get to know the man's thinking, was also meant to introduce a kind of calendar. There were to be a great number of anniversaries dedicated to such figures as Newton or Galileo as representatives of positivist sciences. Those days of the year were to be devoted to the veneration of the individuals concerned. Other days were to be given to calumniating individuals, such as Julius the Apostate or Napoleon. This, too, was to be regulated. Life in general was to be largely regulated according to the principles of positivist science. If you know life, you'll know that not many people want to put the ideals of Auguste Comte into practice, but that is sheer cowardice, for in truth people do think the way Auguste Comte did. If you study the image presented by his positivist church, you will certainly gain the impression that the structure of that church is exactly the same as that of the Roman Catholic Church, although Auguste Comte's positivist church lacks the Christ. And this is what is so strange. We have to consider it utterly characteristic that Auguste Comte was looking for a Roman Catholic Church without Christianity. He arrived at this by letting the three stages, demonic, metaphysical, and positivist, enter into his soul. We might say that he considered all the trappings of Christianity that evolved in the course of history up to his time as something that was very good, but he wanted to remove the Christ himself from that church of his. Basically, that is the essence of Auguste Comte, a Roman Catholic Church without the Christ. This is highly characteristic for the dawn of the fifth post-Atlantean era. Someone who had taken up Romanism was thinking in a Romanist way, and at the same time was entirely thinking in the way of the fifth post-Atlantean era, with its anti-spiritual character, had to think the way Auguste Comte did. Auguste Comte and his teacher, Saint Simon, are therefore absolutely characteristic of the dawn of the fifth post-Atlantean age. But much would be decided in this fifth post-Atlantean era, and therefore the other nuances which are also possible also came up. As I said, I want to give you some glimpses of history today. We'll then develop things on that basis. Schelling, who lived from 1775 to 1854, is in remarkable contrast to Auguste Comte. He is equally characteristic, as it were, of the dawn of the fifth post-Atlantean era. Today I cannot even schematically go into Schelling's philosophy, highly differentiated in itself, of course, but I'd like to refer to a few things that are characteristic. I said that in the evening twilight of the fourth post-Atlantean era, Augustine's position was to consider the one stream, the ideal one, in such a way that a fixed point might arise from it, where he might take his position. We now enter into the fifth post-Atlantean era. In its dawn, we have figures like Saint Simon and Auguste Comte, who were looking for the firm base in the other, the purely natural, material order of positivist sciences. This gives us the two directions, Augustine on the one hand, Auguste Comte on the other. Schelling used the means available in the fifth post-Atlantean era to look behind the things one is able to see in the world for a bridge between the ideal and the real, the ideal and the material. You'll find the main points in my book titled The Riddle of Man. He showed tremendous energy in looking for a way of reconciling these opposites. Initially, he only developed abstract ideas. By starting from the same base as Johann Gottlieb Fichte, he made some progress and tried to come to something in the world that was ideal and real at one and the same time. There followed a time in Schelling's life when he felt it was impossible to arrive at such a bridge using the means of abstraction which had evolved in the course of time in that era. It seemed to him that this was impossible. One day, he said to himself, quote, "People really have only gained these concepts for understanding the natural order outside on the basis of modern scholarship. But we have no concepts for anything which is behind this outer natural order, the sphere where a bridge can be built between the ideal and the real." Close quote. And it is most interesting that one day Schelling admitted that it seemed to him that the academics of recent centuries had come to a secret agreement, that they would exclude anything deeper from their philosophy of life, anything that would lead to true and genuine life. One would therefore have to go to the non-academic people. This was also the time when Schelling considered the works of Jacob Boehme. There he found the spiritual deepening which led to the last, the theosophical period in his life, from which has come the beautiful work on human freedom, the beautiful work on the gods of Samothrace, on the Kabiri, then his title Philosophy of Mythologies, and title Philosophy of Revelation. Schelling was seeking, especially during this last part of his life, to understand what influence the mystery on Golgotha had had on human history. This was what he wanted to know above all else. And he came to realize that the concepts available to the scholars of his day would not enable people to understand the life where the mystery on Golgotha was flowing, and therefore also not the true life of man. Schelling, and that is the trait which I want to draw special attention to, we'll make this the basis for further study in the days ahead, arrived at a view that was the absolute opposite of the view held by his contemporary, Auguste Comte. And this is the strange thing. We are able to say that Auguste Comte was looking for a Catholicism, or rather a Roman Catholic Church, that was without Christianity. Schelling was looking, from his point of view, for a Christianity without a church. A Christianity without a church. Schelling was, as it were, seeking to Christianize the whole of modern life, make it wholly Christian, so that everything human beings are able to think, feel, and do would have the Christ impulse pulsing through it. What he was not looking for was a separate religious life for Christianity, especially not on the pattern that already existed in historical evolution, though he did take a careful look at this life. We thus have the two extremes, Auguste Comte's idea of a church without the Christ, and Schelling's idea of the Christ without a church. I wanted to speak to you about these two historical views, so that we may make this our basis. We see one individual, Augustine, seeking a firm base in idealism. Another individual, Auguste Comte, who was looking for this in realism. And Schelling, who wanted to build a bridge. All these were tendencies that preceded the evolution in which we now find ourselves. What we can say is that one can survey what happened through many centuries, what went on where philosophies of life are concerned, and one can then turn one's attention to the way in which people's ideas evolved in a wider context. Study of Auguste Comte yields a most important aperçu. But Auguste Comte was not able to grasp it in its pure form, being wholly caught up in his prejudices. However, we get something that will be an important starting point for us in the next few days if we consider the whole situation. I'd say Augustine, Auguste Comte, Schelling. I want to come to this aperçu when we conclude today's reflections, for I would wish you to have it in mind. In the next few days, we'll then speak of something which is connected with this aperçu in a most significant way, as it has arisen from the subject matter I have been presenting. I will give it to you in aphoristic form, without being able to go into reasons why this aperçu has come up not with Auguste Comte, but with others when one takes the standpoint of a later time, as I put it today, and takes a point of view which is much later, the standpoint of someone who, at the beginning of the 20th century, thinks about someone who was a thinker at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century. But it really is important. I have stressed this many times over and also brought out clearly this time, that today we look at philosophies of life not just in abstract terms and on their own, but in the way in which they are part of the whole life of humanity. This is the only way of coming to a standpoint of reality. We have to consider how it fits into the whole life of humanity. Saint Simon and Auguste Comte clearly understood that they were only able to arrive at their positivism in modern times. That positivism would have been impossible at an earlier time. Auguste Comte in particular was very much aware, quote, "The way I am thinking," close quote, he more or less said to himself, continue quote, "is a way which is only possible in our time," close quote. This is tremendously important in the modern movement and is indeed connected with the aperçu to which I was referring. If one makes the point which Auguste Comte considered to be the starting point for his threefold system, one can say, in his sense, that this threesome is theology, metaphysics, and positivist science, as he called it. Parenthesis, rightly or wrongly so, that does not matter. Parenthesis. The strange thing is that we are able to ask, quote, "Who is most liable to be a believer where one of these directions is concerned?" Close quote. Please, do not misunderstand me with regard to what I am now going to say with reference to the aperçu, and do not take it as a one-sided dogma, nor to take it as it might be crudely observed with absolute certainty. Readers aside, the word aperçu, which I believe I'm spelling correctly, I don't actually know the meaning of it at the moment, but it's spelled A-P-E-R-C with a little mark under it, U. A-P-E-R-C-U, aperçu. My apologies, end of readers aside. No, we have to consider the whole course of human evolution if we want to turn our attention to the words I am now going to say. But in that case, we cannot ask, quote, who'll be the believer, close quote, but, quote, who'll be most likely to be a believer in one of these directions, close quote. Careful observation will then show, however much the facts would seem to contradict this, that the one most likely to be a believer in theology, not a representative of theology, but a believer, I am not talking about religion, but about theology, is the soldier. Civil servants, especially in the legal field, are most likely to believe in metaphysics. And industrialists will most easily come to believe in positivist sciences. When one wants to judge life, it is most important not to be abstract, but to look at life in a truly unbiased way. But one then has to raise questions like these. Coming to a conclusion today, I want you to treat this as an aperçu, something which comes to mind when one enters more intimately into Auguste Comte's thinking. He was aware that he could only be fully understood by industrialists, and could really only come up with his views in an industrial age. This is connected with the fact that an industrialist will most easily believe in positivist science, a soldier in not just the Christian but any theology, and the civil servant in metaphysics. The end of Lecture 1.